Well, thanks, Almut, for the very flattering introduction. Thanks to Misha for convincing me to come here. I have actually done something like this before, 5, 6 years ago in Germany, where we spent a whole week with physics teachers locked up in a nice building with a nice cellar where they provided every day, they provided a barrel of beer and very nice German food. And so we spent discussing about the science topics, but also about teaching and maybe how to explain things and so on. It was a pleasure. So it was fairly easy for Misha actually to convince me to come here, because I think it's an important thing to do. Right, and then of course I had to think, what am I going to teach? So I had 50 minutes. And five years ago when I did this in Germany, I had had a talk, and I was about to give that one here. But then I thought, well, various reasons for not doing that. One reason was that, well, I mean, I gave this already 5, 6 years ago, and it was based on work that I did even earlier. So when work gets a bit sort of, when a topic gets a bit older, you get less enthusiastic about it. So I certainly, I mean, it was of course very nice work. I think it's always important to really, when you speak about something, you really have to enjoy it. And Misha actually completely agreed with me. And so I'm going to talk about something that I'm really excited about at the moment. So actually, at the end of the talk, I will explain in very general terms something that I've only done a few months ago. So really, that's very cutting edge research in a way. Of course, the talk will start much earlier. In fact, it will start about 100 years ago or so. Because I will also explain some basic features of quantum mechanics, again reminding you of some certain aspects that will be important for the rest of the talk. And so the whole thing, the whole lecture will be broadly about quantum control, because it's about a particular field that uses quantum control, and that's quantum information science or quantum information theory. That's the field that some of you have heard about, well, building quantum computers and these sort of things, quantum cryptography and all that sort of stuff. So in a way, it will be about that. But rather than giving you an overview over the field, what I want to really achieve is that I want to give you an idea of why there is sort of a hype for this field now. What is different? What is new? Because it really is based on quantum mechanics as we know it for 80 or 90 years. So there must be something in addition. And so I will try and bring out this idea a little bit, and then I show you this, how this idea applies in two cases. One is a more quantum information theory application, and the other one is actually something that we are really interested in now, and that's applying quantum mechanics and some of these ideas to photosynthesis. So almost biophysics, so to speak. So that's it. So what... First, I would like to motivate briefly one reason why one may want to do quantum information processing, quantum control, and all these things. And that is the following. When you look at technological development, you will see that there are plenty of sort of exponential growth laws. So many of you, or at least the students that you are teaching, they all have iPods and all sorts of computers and mobile phones that they may even use in class when you don't like it. And these are all electronic devices, and every year you basically buy a new one because the new one is so much better than the old one. Every year they get about twice as good as, let's say, in the year before. Twice as good meaning the memory grows is twice as large for the same amount of dollars, or the computational power, the speed of the device is twice as fast if it's a laptop or so, roughly, and always for the same amount of money. I mean, laptops have not become really much more expensive over the years, but they have become much more powerful. And this is, you have this sort of growth that something becomes better by a constant rate in various things like communication capacity, computational power, measurement precision, actually. The quality with which you can measure time increases also with such a law. Even energy efficiency and energy consumption, which is the bad part, also follows such a law. And here's one first example, and this is a plot, basically, which shows here time And here is the uncertainty in a logarithmic scale of atomic clocks. Well, and so what you have here is these are different designs of atomic clocks, and you see that this is a straight line. What that means is that every year the atomic clocks become more precise by a fixed factor. So it's, again, they grow in power or accuracy exponentially in time. And at some point, then, you have to start to use all sorts of quantum mechanical tricks like laser cooling and so on to drive this development further. And there were also various other innovations that had to be achieved. So always there are some innovative steps in between. And so you can ask, so what is this good for? Well, that's actually an old clock here. That's National Physical Laboratory in 1955. That's an atomic clock. Nowadays, they are much smaller and much better, and they fit into a satellite. And then what you can do is you can send all those satellites up into orbit, and you have quite a lot of satellites here going around. And at every moment in time, every point on Earth sees several of those satellites, or 7, 8, 9. You see it varies a little bit in time. And what this is good for is, well, for this, if you, I mean, probably some of you found their way to the KITP using a navigator. And the navigator actually exchanges signals with the satellites to identify exactly where you are on the road, and then gives you instructions where to turn left and right and whatever. And so that's actually that's a technological application that started out, I mean, 55, in some actually, well, in a way, fundamental research, and ended up with a really practical application. And what one has to say is that this only works because these atomic clocks are really very, very precise. Because what they have to do is they have to exchange signals with your device, and they have to measure the time these signals take. And then they do this from different places in space, and from that they can work out where you are, taking into account special and general relativity as well, actually. So that's another amazing thing. If general relativity wouldn't have been discovered by now, that would have discovered it, because there would have been inaccuracies that people wouldn't have been able to explain, and eventually they would have found their way. Of course, I mean, Einstein didn't need that. But it's still, I mean, this again shows you sort of, you know, how this constant improvement of the precision of such devices like atomic clocks can have commercial payoffs, but also potentially fundamental science payoffs. There's of course, the other thing that is happening and that you all know, I mean, like that's the increase in computational power. And so here, I start with a very rudimentary, it's not really a computer in the common sense, but this is a tide predictor that Lord Kelvin constructed. And that's from 1872, and it had a certain computational power in the sense that it could do a certain number of computational steps per second per $1,000. So, I mean, this one, I don't remember what it cost, but let's say it was $1,000. So I asked the question, how much computational power does $1,000 cost over time? And so then you can, there's various developments. Eventually, you go from these mechanical devices to sort of electrical devices. That's a Zuse Z3 that was built in Germany. It's a programmable computer, and that had a rate of computations about 1 per second or so. Then here is the ETSAC, that was an electrical, how do you call those? Well, one of them with these inside. And that was a bit faster. That is my personal favorite computer. It was my first one ever. That was in 1984. I bought that. All my life savings went into that one. Which means you can see that I didn't have very much, because it was actually less than $1,000. But I mean, this one already had a 1 megahertz. That means could do about 1 million operations, very fundamental operations per second. So that's already an enormous improvement over this 1 per second here. And nowadays, the computers look like that. Not much difference in the way they look now. And they are faster, by another factor of about 1 to 2 to 3,000 or something like that. They run in gigahertz, so a billion computations per second. And so that's sort of that's an improvement. It's again a logarithmic plot here, so it's more or less a straight line. It's accelerating even a little bit. So again, computational power grows doubles every year, roughly, every year or every 18 months. And so this is a smooth development. But what you actually see is also here that there's something else. We change technologies all the time. Initially, it was mechanical and electrical. Then it was valves, then transistors, integrated circuits, and so on. And in fact, that was absolutely necessary. Each of these technologies, a mechanical computer cannot work at a gigahertz rate, you can imagine. So it was absolutely necessary. And what happened was that at every time, so we tried to improve the old technology up to a state where, well, then you started to realize, oh, it's getting harder and harder and harder to do it. And then a new technology came along and helped you to continue this growth in computational power. And so rather than being a smooth development, it's actually a sort of a sequence of, well, almost revolutions in the way that new technology, new ideas, well, or even new physical theories came along. I mean, from mechanical to actually quantum mechanics. I mean, quantum mechanics is needed to understand solid state physics in the end. So that's interesting. But of course, now you can ask, well, what happens when we continue this development? Where's the next roadblock? And the next roadblock, we can sort of expect already what will happen. If we improve the computational power of computers, that means that the structures on the microchip become smaller and smaller. Every year they become smaller by a constant factor. And that means that eventually, if we just simply extrapolate this around here, the structures will become atom size. And therefore, you really then have to wonder what happens when I try and make such small structures. Somehow, quantum mechanics must really come into play in a very, very important way, because individual atoms or small, very small structures follow the laws of quantum mechanics. They suffer all sorts of quantum noise and all sorts of things like that. And therefore, it's not a bad idea to start to think now what we can do about that. How can we control matter at such small scales to our advantage? Okay. So that is certainly one other motivation for looking at quantum control of matter. So we want to, and we almost have no choice, because technological progress, I mean, drives us towards that, and we want to have better and better computers all the time. And so that's an observation simply. Of course, there's this threat that if you have, well, quantum mechanical systems, they are very small, they suffer quantum fluctuations, noise, basically. And we wonder whether that actually just prevents us from making devices smaller. Can we use quantum mechanics in any way, or do these quantum fluctuations destroy everything? Oops. Ah, yeah, okay. And so people have started to worry about this quite a long time ago, actually. And they are doing all sorts of, studying all sorts of physical devices. These are very, very cold atoms, Bose-Einstein condensates, they're nanokelvins cold, these are cold atoms, cavities that trap light, and I'm sure that Peter Knight will tell you a lot more about this, ion traps which cool ions to microkelvin temperatures, and photonic devices. All sorts of things are being now studied with the aim of really learning how to control those systems at the single quantum level. Now, this would sound like an engineering exercise, but really the point is also there's another thing that quantum information actually did for us, you know, and that was a realization that some of these quantum properties may actually be of advantage for us. They may be quantum noise from one point of view, but they might actually be something really, really useful from another point of view. And so quantum noise, or the fragility of quantum systems, is one such thing. Entanglement, that you may have heard quite a bit in the press and popular science articles, is another of those properties that we are now using to our advantage. And this is, in a way, it's really a paradigm change in that we take something that is perceived normally as bad and we turn it into something to our advantage. And the most crucial, the most strongest contrast that one can make, I think, is quantum noise. And that's why I want to explain to you how quantum noise and the fragility of quantum systems can actually be used to your advantage. Right, and for that, I have to remind you a little bit about quantum mechanics, just a little bit, I mean. And here is a simple experiment. So here you have a light bulb, and here you have a photodetector that, that looks whether there's light or not. And this is what the detector sees. Over time, he sees a lot of clicks. He sees intensity. There are small fluctuations up and down, but basically he sees an almost constant intensity. And now what we can do is we can sort of make the light bulb dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And what you observe is that, of course, the intensity goes down, but not completely in a uniform way. What happens is that the fluctuations become stronger. And you can take this to the extreme, where you make a very, very faint light bulb, and you send this into a detector, and then what the detector will do is it will click at individual moments in time and say, here, I saw something, then I didn't see something for a while, then I saw again something. So seeing something means he sees some light. And what this shows you is that light is somehow quantized into little units, and they flies towards the detector, and at a very specific moment in time, it creates a signal in the detector. So light is created out of little units, and we call them photons. Okay? And in this picture, at least, they behave like little particles. So let's make a slightly more sophisticated experiment. Take two detectors, the old one that we had, here another one, and here we put a thin sheet of glass, which is a beam splitter. And what it does is, with 50% of the intensity that comes in, is reflected off to the top, and 50% goes down to the bottom. And now you have a look. Again, you send very faint light in here, and you wonder, when does this detector click, and when does that detector click? And so I magnified the size of the blips here a little bit just to make them better visible. They still indicate one sort of click in the detector. And what you will see is it's either this detector clicks, but then this one doesn't click, or it's this one clicking, and then that one doesn't click. So photon goes one way or the other. Okay, that's pretty much what we expect. It's a particle. I mean, it has to make a choice. It goes one way or the other. Now I want to start and challenge us a little bit. Let's make an even more complicated experiment. Not very much more, but here we have our original beam splitter. Here we have our two detectors. But now I add another beam splitter and two mirrors. Okay, and this device is called a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So it's a name for a device. And so what will happen is here the light comes in from the top here. And then it's split up here or down here. So either the photon goes down here, up here, or it goes down there. Then it comes down to this mirror here. It's reflected off, comes up here. And, well, then it has to make a choice, right? So either it goes here or here. And if the photon goes that path, well, also comes here. So the beam splitter makes a choice, either up or down. So what we expect is, of course, that we will see exactly the same thing again. So half of the photons will arrive in the upper detector, half of the photons will arrive in the lower detector. And if this detector clicks, then this one doesn't click. So that's the expectation that we have from this particle picture. And now we have to do something that one has to do as a physicist. One has a prediction and one does an experiment and checks what nature tells you. Because in the end, we want to describe nature, and so we have to ask what really is the case, whether our theory is right or wrong. Well, it's completely wrong. This is what is happening. All the photons, every single one, will come out at the bottom detector here. So it will be detected here, and nothing comes out here. Now, and this tells you that actually photons don't only have a particle character, they also have a wave character at the same time. And why is that? Well, what you actually have to do to work out whether the photon is detected, what the probability is for the photon to arrive here and here, you have to basically take a wave picture and see how the waves propagate through the system. It goes here and here. And then like water waves almost, they will be superimposed here and they cancel off completely in this path and they are actually amplified in this path. And that is really what wave mechanics predicts for you. Okay? And so that is, you know, really, I mean, this is something that you have to test in nature, and otherwise, well, there's no reason why it has to be like that. Yes? Sorry? Yes, yeah, so this is the two paths, the wave the two waves in this path and that path will have a different relative phase. And so in the upper path, so one of the waves is at the bottom and the other one is at the top. So they exactly cancel each other, while in the lower path, they are shifted with respect to each other so that the maxima are at the same place and they add up together. And therefore, the light comes out at the bottom. That's... okay, so how does one explain that in the... it's basically in the end it's a difference in it's a path length difference. In fact, you can actually change this and you can make sure that all the photons come out here by changing the relative length of the two paths. Yeah, so you can, for example, move the mirror a little bit down and then the relative balancing would change. So, but the point is, if you balance this thing right, all the photons will come out in one detector. So that's right. And you could, in principle, do this with water waves. If you build sort of a canal system and so on, it doesn't work very well, I think, but in principle, you could do it with water waves and you would see such a phenomenon. Yeah. Actually, there are some nice movies in the web that you can find where you can do some sort of interference effects with water waves, and so you can see some. Very good. I switched the transparency too quickly. So now we have here a tension. Somehow, we would like to think of photons as particles, but on the other hand, they seem to have a wave character. And so we can try and resolve this by saying, well, why don't we just try and look in the device where the photon has gone, which path, right? So we make a little observer here that checks whether the photon has passed through here or, let's say, passed through here. And if we do this, then we automatically perturb this interference. And indeed, we sort of bring out more the particle character again. If we know that the photon has passed through this path here, then, well, it has come here. And here, it does make a decision between up or down. It has nothing to interfere with here. And it will, in half the cases, go up here, and in half the cases, go down here. Okay. And the key point about this is, if you observe a quantum system and you gain some information about it, like which path did the photon take, you automatically perturb the system. And it's perturbed in a way that you can test. Here, the perturbation is that all of a sudden the detector up there is starting to click. Yeah? And therefore, you know that if you build this device here, you know there must be someone inside messing about the system trying to find out where the photon went. Okay. So perturbations by observers can be detected. Right, so a brief summary of this sort of quantum mechanics introduction. Roughly speaking, well, when the system is evolving freely without observation in between, then it exhibits a wave character, and if you measure the system, then it tends to exhibit a quantum particle character. That's a rough summary. And important for the rest of the talk is measurements that acquire some information about the system. As you make a measurement on a quantum system and you get some information, whatever it is, it will lead to a perturbation of the system. In this interferometer, if we try to find out which path the photon took, the detectors will behave. They will see a different result than if you have not tried to find out which path the photon took. Okay? So that's an important point. And this is... really, it can even be made quantitative. If you gain a little bit of information, the perturbation is small. If you gain a lot of information, the perturbation is large. Yes? Sure. Well, that's, for example, the fact that you have interference between in this interferometer, right? If you have a wave that has... well, it's like a perfect sine wave, for example, that I would call a very coherent wave that is able to interfere with another one of those sine waves, destructively or constructively. Well, if it's not really a perfect sine wave, but a mixture of many different ones. Yeah, exactly. Okay, and now what I want to do is, this was a basic feature of quantum mechanics that I sort of, well, if not explained, at least showed you. And now one would say, okay, so systems, quantum mechanical systems, are very fragile to interference measurements from the outside. And that's a problem. And in fact, what we are doing in a lot of quantum control is about trying to get rid of the influence from environments and people that might meddle with quantum systems and try to insulate the quantum systems from the environment and correct for errors. And well, that's one way of approaching things, but maybe it might also be a clever idea to try and see whether this fragility of quantum systems can be to our advantage. And that's I will now show you an example, a very important one, where this is exactly the case. And that has to do with secrecy. We all all have secrets here and there. And sometimes we have some collaborators, let's say, with whom we would like to share this secret in such a way that nobody else can listen to it. And what I'm doing right now is not a clever way of sharing secrets. I mean, I'm talking publicly in an open space and everybody can listen in. And in particular, this is I cannot even check whether you're listening or not. I mean, some of you might just fall asleep and then, you know, I can have a guess that you may not be listening anymore. But if you're just looking at me and I'm speaking, I cannot be sure, are you listening to me or not? Are you extracting this information from what I'm saying or not? And if I want to speak to, let's say, to Misha and want to tell him something secret, I can't do it. I just speak to him and all of you in principle can listen in. And that's because the sound waves that I'm using are classical objects. I mean, they are, anybody of you can just listen in, and the perturbation that this will do to these sound waves is very, very, very small, and I cannot really see that. So that's a problem, and that's a problem actually completely in general. If you buy books on a well-known bookseller on the internet, you will actually use your credit card to pay for it. You have to transmit your credit card number, your security code, and various other things, and you would like to somehow be sure that nobody else is listening in, because otherwise they buy the books, buy even more books with your credit card. And you transfer this over the internet. And at present, this is done by sort of clever encoding of the information using some mathematical concepts. But the security of these codes is not proven, actually. People believe that they are good, but it's not clear at all whether there's not someone in the world that can actually decipher the code. And it may well be that this is already happening. It's just that this person hasn't told us. Might be your government, for example. And this is an old problem. And humanity has had this problem for a long, long time. And so here are various other ways of encoding things. So this is, I've forgotten what the name is, and if I remember that last time I tried to pronounce it, I couldn't do it. But basically what this is it's from Greek times. So they take a piece of wood, they take a leather strap, wrap it around, then they write the message, and then they take the piece of wood away and the leather strap off, and it's given to a messenger. He goes somewhere else, goes to the receiver, and the receiver has a piece of wood with the same diameter, puts the leather around it, and he can reconstruct the message from it. If the piece of wood would be too thick or too thin, he would scramble up the message. It's not a very secure thing. I mean, you can try out a few pieces of wood and you would probably can decipher it. But I mean, it has a certain level of security. And the important point here is that sender and receiver need to share something that is equal. So then there's another one. That was used in the Second World War. That's a much more sophisticated device for encoding. But what it does is it takes a message, and then for every letter in the message, it associates a different letter to it. And it does this by a device that creates pseudo-random combinations of numbers, and then they look in the code book and they transfer the message. And of course, the receiver of such an encoded message has to have an analogous device. And then he can decipher it, the message, by just undoing this whole process. And this was actually pretty safe. I mean, much safer than this one here. But it was not safe enough, because in the end it was broken. That's the Enigma, and it was broken by the British and Polish scientists. I mean, Turing was very important in that endeavor. But again, same thing, sender and receiver need to share something. Okay. So now let's abstract this a little bit. There will only be two formulas in the talk, and this is one, basically. So really, instead of speaking about pieces of wood or some mechanical devices, we just speak of keys. And nowadays, they would be sequences of zeros and ones that are random. So each entry here is chosen randomly, but it's perfectly correlated to the entry in the codebook of the receiver. That's sender, that's receiver. These are random numbers, but the first digit here is the same as the first digit here. The second digit here is the same as the second digit here, and so on. And that means they share the same codebook. Okay? And then you can use such a set of random numbers, for example, to encode a message here and then decode it on the other side. But now you still have a problem. How do you manage to have the same codebook for sender and receiver? With Misha, I still have the same problem. He's at the back of the room, I'm at the front of the room. What do we do? Well, of course, we could have come together beforehand and exchanged our codebooks, and could have written down my numbers, he would have copied them, we would have gone and separated. And then I could have started to transmit my messages. But the problem, of course, is that, if I'm talking a bit too much, at some point I have used up the code. Each part of the code I can use only really once to make it absolutely safe. And so how do we refresh the code? I don't want to run up there and talk to Misha directly, because then I could have done this in the first place. And often it's physically not possible. If you buy from your bookseller on the internet, you cannot just go there. I mean, that defeats the whole point. So we have to find something else, right? And here, this is exactly where quantum mechanics and the fragility of quantum systems comes to our aid now. Right, so Alice and Bob, that's the standard name for in information theory for protagonists in various games and communication schemes. So Alice is sender and Bob is usually receiver. They are far away from each other. And they would like to communicate with each other through a public channel, like I do with Misha right now, in such a way that they can exchange information that only sender and receiver can decode, and nobody else. How can they do that? Well, if I do it with classical system signals, that's not going to work, because you can just listen in. You don't perturb classical objects by measuring them, and I can never find out whether anybody has listened in to our conversation. So we have to do something else. And what is this something else? Well, we have to use individual quanta, because individual quanta, as I explained to you, are very, very fragile to any form of interference. So if I encode my information with quantum bits, quantum mechanical systems, that means, for example, the electronic degrees of freedom of an atom, whether the electron is in the lower state or in the upper state, for example, then the following happens. I send these quantum signals through the channel, and if there's an eavesdropper that tries to measure those particles, he will inevitably make a perturbation. So now what we can do is we can exchange some of these particles between Alice and Bob, and then afterwards they just make 100 of those or so. And afterwards they say, okay, now we want to see whether there's an eavesdropper in between. And therefore what they do is they take those the first 100 signals, and they publicly announce what they were. And they have, if everything was perfect and there's no eavesdropper in between, there was no perturbation, so they have to be the same. If there's an eavesdropper in between, there will be some errors. And then, if there are some errors, they know, aha, there's someone on the line listening in. So now there are different strategies. Strategy A is walk along the line, find the guy, shoot him, and then continue. The other way is use clever information theory to get rid of the guy. And this is something that is difficult to explain because these are very sophisticated algorithms. But the principle is really, the idea is the following. You have to make sure that by making this test, so you exchange a lot of messages, you take a subset of them, you check whether there's some noise on them, and the level of noise tells you how strongly the eavesdropper has interfered with your transmissions. The more noise, the more strongly the eavesdropper has interfered with your messages. So that gives you a quantitative way in which to know, to put an upper bound on the information that the eavesdropper can have gotten. That is important and fundamentally different from classical physics. And the advantage is that we just have to make sure that Alice and Bob share more information about the message than Eve has, the eavesdropper. If that's the case, then there are clever methods from information theory that can sacrifice part of the messages. And in this way, well, I mean, reduce the amount of usable messages for Alice and Bob, but also remove the reduce the knowledge that Eve has about the messages. And you can make this in several steps and go further and further. And in the end, you have a small subset of all the messages that you have sent. And for those, you can guarantee that the eavesdropper has no knowledge about. They are perfect. They're perfectly correlated between the sender and the receiver. There's no perturbation. And the eavesdropper could not have learned about them. Now, this is the idea. This is not so straightforward to prove. And this is what information theorists do, and quantum information theorists as well, it's at least a certain type of them. But the fundamental idea is eavesdroppers will perturb a quantum mechanical system, and they cannot avoid it. Nature tells us that. That's the way quantum mechanics is. Well, what you basically achieve with that is that, so you are able to select a subset of the messages that the eavesdropper has not actually tried to measure or has not gained any information from. Well, okay, so you never get to absolutely zero, but you can go to arbitrarily low levels. So that's so you can never have absolute perfection with these things. But in the end, when you say, well, the knowledge that the receiver has is 10 to the minus 100 or so, well, it's fine. So that's then good enough. But I mean, this has to be in the specification of your device in the end. This and that level of security it does give you. And if you're not happy with that, you may have to pay more money and you get a device that provides you more. And in principle, you can force more and more and more security. Okay. And well, I mean, this is something that was invented in 1984 by Bennett and Brassard, building on ideas of Stephen Wiesner. And so Jules Brassard is now a Canadian computer scientist. Charles Bennett is at IBM Watson Laboratory, an American physicist. And Stephen Wiesner was is now living in Israel, actually. And so about 20 years ago, that was conceived as an idea. Well, people can build this. It's been demonstrated. There are little companies that try to sell that. And there are various demonstrations using Swiss Telecom optical fibers, for example, exchanging photons in that case, sending them between different places, and demonstrating that this works reasonably well. And then you always have to look into the small print and see what this really means in terms of security level. And there's also an exciting thing that is being pursued by a consortium that is called SpaceQuest and is led by Anton Zeilinger. They want to do this secret communication with satellites. And then it's great. So a satellite passes here, you exchange code with him, then it flies along to the other side of the world, London. And when I exchange in London, I exchange my messages. And you only have to trust, of course, that nobody in the middle interfered with the satellite. But, you know, it's very far up there. And the advantage is that in that way, you can much, well, potentially more easily create a global quantum communication network. It's not so straightforward to do this with optical fibers, because fibers, if you make them longer than 100 kilometers, if you send a photon through, try to send a photon through, it will not arrive anymore because it is being absorbed. It's roughly the absorption length. There are tricks how one can get around this maybe, but they are also technologically demanding and they are also being pursued. Okay, so that was the information theoretic application. So that's one of the things that quantum information is doing. It takes these very crucial features of quantum mechanics and uses them to their advantage. Now I want to show you something else, and that is really new. And that's what I'm really excited about, actually. And that is now biology. And what we are looking at here is photosynthesis. And so, well, everybody knows what photosynthesis is. So that's a tree, has a leaf, has a cell. In the cell, there's chlorophyll that absorbs light, and somehow then there's a chemical reaction initiated, and eventually it breaks down, uses water and carbon dioxide and breaks it down into oxygen and sugar. Well, or everything that is needed for the plant to live, basically. And for us, importantly, it breaks down carbon dioxide to sugar. Yeah, there was a question. I mean, there are various errors that can happen in an optical fiber, but it's not necessarily, it's only, what do you say, total internal diffraction. It can just be the photon can be absorbed, or it can be lost through the fiber walls and stuff like that. So it in the end, you have, sorry? No, I mean photons at about 100 kilometer or 150 kilometer distance or so, they just are absorbed. They vanish, yeah. And that's why this is a natural length limit in a way that you have. Okay, so right here. So Well, so that's a tree. I'm not actually the work that. So what I'm presenting you here applies to these trees or as well. So for plant-based photosynthesis. But the way we looked at it actually was in bacterial photosynthesis. That means you have little bacteria. This is a particular specimen. It's a green sulfur bacterium. And they do photosynthesis. They live off that. And in fact, these green sulfur bacteria, they live at the bottom of lakes. And sometimes even lower, they live at the bottom of oceans. And some very, very specific places. Because if you are like 2,000 meter deep at the bottom of the sea, there is no light. I mean, water absorbs light, there's just no photon coming through, or essentially no photon. But what exists actually, and that is a discovery that's relatively recent, I mean, maybe 20 years old or so, there's what is called black smokers. And there's sort of super hot water is coming out from the seabed. There's some volcanic activity so it's just very hot water. And it's actually about 400 degrees hot. So around here, it is very, very warm. And so that means there is a very, very faint thermal glow. I mean, it's 400 degrees. I mean, if you see your barbecue or so, it's about 1,000 or so. You see that it's really radiating light. Well, at 400 degrees, there's also a bit of radiation, but not very much. But it turns out that around these black smokers, there are these green sulfur bacteria living, for example. And of them, there are other organisms are feeding off them. There is actually a little ecosystem around these at the right distance so that they're not boiled, but also not too far, that they don't see any radiation. And these green sulfur bacteria must obviously be extremely efficient in their photosynthesis, as you can see from that. And so we got a little bit interested in that, actually. And this was mainly motivated by experiments that were done at University of California, Berkeley, by Graham Fleming, who did spectroscopy of such systems and found some things that I'll tell you about. And so what is happening there? So this is roughly how the photosynthetic complex looks like. So here's what is called the reaction center. This is where you want to have the energy from the light so that it can start chemical reactions. And then there's a lot of complicated additional stages that are happening there. But here it's sort of initiated. The problem is that this reaction center is very small. It's actually so small that it absorbs light at a rate that is about 100 to 1,000 times, or roughly 100 times smaller than the rate at which it can process this energy. So most of the time, this reaction center would not be busy. And nature doesn't tend to like this, it seems. So what nature has done is it has said, okay, let's build some antennas around this. So additional molecules, bigger, and they also absorb light. And now, of course, the energy is in the wrong place. So here are these antennas, yeah, as an example. So somewhere here the light has been absorbed, so the energy is up here, but you want it here. So it has to be transported through some additional complexes from the antenna to the reaction center. Okay, and that's quite natural. And nature has arranged it in such a way that there are sufficiently antennas so that, on average, the reaction center always has to process a quantum of energy. So it's always busy. Not too busy, but just busy enough so that it doesn't sit idle. And now people have been looking at just this transport canal here. And they have been wondering, how efficient is this? Is it 10%, 20%? That meaning, if we put some energy up here, how much of the energy arrives at the reaction center? And it turns out that the efficiency is in the very high 90%. So what you stick up, stick in there at the top, comes out at the bottom. And you like it like that because it has to be really, you don't want to have losses on that way. And now that's another picture of this complex. It's basically, I mean, it has thousands and thousands and thousands of atoms. What we wanted to understand now is, why is this so efficient? Okay, and well, that's another picture of this complex. So each of these nodes here is an atom. This is a hydrogen. There's lots of stuff in there. And being theoretical physicists, of course, we simplify the matter a lot. We don't want to deal with a simulation of these thousands and thousands of atoms because this is really almost undoable. We do not want to know all the details. We will just want to take some experimental data, build a simplified model that is simple so that we can understand some basic features, but complicated enough that it still reflects essentially the dynamics of the system. And So what we do is we look at this complex, and from experimental data, we learn that basically there are seven big molecules that are loosely bound together in this complex. So there are seven big places where energy can exist. And the energy is transformed from a photon into an excited electron. And that is sort of either the excited electron is either sitting here or here or here or here or here or here. So in one of these seven sites. And these sites are coupled to each other. So that means that this excited electron can hop between these different sites. Okay? Right. And so from now on, I just forget about all the complicated atomic structure, and I just look at such a simple network of several sites that can exchange excitation energy between them. And now I want to know, if I stick some energy up here, how likely is it that the energy comes out down here and is transferred into the reaction center? And there are different processes. So there's this exchange interaction, so that's the hopping of the excitation. And of course, such an excitation can also be lost again. It can just be re-radiated into the environment, for example, and that's bad. That's a process that the cell doesn't want, because then this energy is not really arriving here at the reaction center where it does photosynthesis. And, okay. Now, there are different ways of describing that. In fact, the original way of describing these things was done in the, let's say, in the 60s. And there were several people who certainly were involved in that, but one of them got a Nobel Prize, that's Marcus. And he sort of looked at mostly at processes that are like a classical random process, where electron can really be said to be either in one side or the other, so no wave features involved. And I mean, you get reasonable answers, and I mean, obviously, he deciphered a lot of the mechanisms there, so he did very important work. But what happened in 2007 is that Graham Fleming did an experiment on these complexes, and basically he sent laser pulses onto the complex and looked at the light that is re-radiated, basically, and there he saw some oscillations, and these oscillations were a sign that there is some wave-like phenomenon taking place. So it's not just the classical, you cannot understand this process entirely on the level of classical random processes, but really you have to take into account the wave character of these excitations again. Right. And you need this to explain certainly all sorts of features like optical spectra. I'm nearly done. And right, so let's do that. So let's take quantum mechanics and try and explain the dynamics of this complex and the transfer rate. So we are sticking an excitation at the top. I use quantum mechanics and I look what is the probability that the excitation arrives at the bottom. And you will see here, well, the transfer efficiency is about 50%, 60%, something like that. Nowhere near the high 90% efficiency. And even worse, here, I looked at a time scale of 5 picoseconds. That's the time from experiments that we know that the transfer is roughly taking place. I mean, give or take a few picoseconds. When you look at the next plot, which plots this on a longer time scale, you see that actually even after 50 picoseconds, it's still not finished. And actually, it really saturates up here. It's completely finished. It's not such a purely quantum mechanical model does not reflect correctly the dynamics of these systems. There is something else. So they're not efficient enough and they're too slow. There's something else. And the remarkable thing is that actually noise helps nature to transport the excitation faster. And that is, well, that's a bit surprising actually, because normally you would say noise is really something that cannot be very helpful in transport processes. And just to give you an idea why this just might be, We have to remember the Mach-Zehnder interferometer which I showed you before, where you had constructive interference and destructive interference. If I send in a photon in one port, it always came out in one detector and not in the other. And something similar is happening here. So some of the population, some of the energy that you put into the system is actually trapped by destructive interference and it cannot propagate. Okay, and how is that? Well, basically what you see is, and now, well, okay, I cheated. This is another formula. This is actually a quantum mechanical formula. So it just tells you that the excitation in the system is either sitting here or here, and it's a wave-like thing. It's a coherent superposition with a minus sign in between. And now, if you look at such a system, so you have two sides, and both of them try to couple to a third one with the same strength, then this transition amplitude from one and the transition amplitude from the other, they're like waves, so they have wave amplitudes, they have to be added. But then you have a minus sign in between, the two waves are completely, they're just out of phase, so one is at the top and the other one is at the bottom, so exactly these two amplitudes cancel each other out. And if you take this into account and you look at such a quantum network, you will actually find exactly the same, well, almost exactly the same behavior. You see that the transfer saturates at about 50%. And then, now you have to explain how noise can help. Well, what you have to do is you have to take this destructive interference and destroy it. You have to somehow inhibit it a little bit. And when you do this, so you put in a little bit of noise, then indeed, first the system tries to saturate at 50%, but then it rises faster. And if you put more noise in, then the transfer gets better. So what nature has done now is it has actually optimized the noise level in these systems. And probably, I mean, so that's the speculation. So As it turns out, when you look at the system parameters of these biological systems and you optimize the noise level, you can actually explain these high 90% transfer efficiencies and the times in which this transfer is happening. And so it seems that nature has sort of optimized its structure to really exploit both quantum mechanics and the fragility of quantum mechanics at the same time. Right. And so here's a plot that just shows you, well, if there's no noise, you get this. With a little bit of noise, you get a dashed curve. More noise, you get even better transfer and faster. And a bit more noise, you got another curve up here. And there's an optimal noise level. Well, and that is really what is happening in those molecules in this photosynthetic complex. It's just what is happening here. There's destructive and constructive interference. And you put some noise in addition to inhibit the destructive interference. And in fact, I cannot go into detail now because the chair lady is already exactly. But everything that is happening in this molecule, you can understand with this. And that's the last transparency. The really cool thing would now be if we build artificial nanostructures, maybe we can get some, we can now take these ideas of maybe using noise to make them better, because this is something that people would not normally do. You don't normally introduce noise into your carefully created nanostructures. But maybe this is just what you need to do, for example, to make a better solar cell. And the organic solar cells, for example, it could well be that you make them a little bit better. And even if it's just a little bit, if it's a percent more efficiency or so, this might actually already be a big deal. So that's why this is also potentially, this is pure speculation, also of interest for technology again. And with that, I'd like to close. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for a very interesting talk. We have a little bit of time left for questions.
Do you think quantum information theory can be used to detect extraterrestrial aliens who could interfere quantum mechanically and we could detect that?
Well, you should never say never, but I would say extremely unlikely. Because really, for what you're suggesting, that they somehow should interfere with what has happening here is that initially we would have to have some connection, we would have to share some common quantum system with them, and they would have to maybe act on one or part of it. But this is not what is happening. I mean, we cannot extend whatever, a million light years, I mean, it cannot take a photon and send it a million light years away to make it available to some alien. So we would not be able actually to create such a system artificially. And, here. Yeah, okay, but then we probably don't need quantum mechanics either. So I think there are probably, if they exist, there are probably much more direct ways of detecting their presence than using such quantum mechanical effects. The worst is that who knows whether quantum mechanics is really the proper theory. Maybe they know some more sophisticated theory to trick us.
Can we think of this transfer as tunneling processes in which perhaps the barrier width or height is fluctuating because of the motion of the atoms?
Yes. So this is one way of thinking. That's a pretty good picture actually. The way you can see it maybe is imagine you have this large complex and that has different sites. And this complex is actually where the noise is coming from is from the vibrations of this complex. And so you can imagine if it vibrates in the classical picture, the two sides come a bit closer, and therefore, well, their excitation energies change, but also their tunneling rate can change, and it fluctuates, and in that way, actually, you affect the coherence in the system. And in fact, I gave even a reference, so in one of these papers it's explained there are different types of effects that contribute. All have to do with inhibiting destructive interference, and the one that you mentioned is one, and there are two others actually.
And maybe that's part of the mic
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's been part of my question, is the tunneling, because the interferometer that you put up there, when noise is introduced, you lose the coherentness. And so when you had the coherentness, you got 100% transfer, where your green cells, or your green sulfur bacteria, yeah, it was just the opposite. When you had your lack of noise, you got a small transfer rate.
Well, that depends how you see it, no? Because the analogy is not absolutely perfect, but if you think about this interferometer, imagine it's just given to you. And you are the unfortunate guy who is sitting at the top detector, and you would really like to see some light. Well, so then actually the noise in this interferometer, the phase noise or the measurement, actually would help you, and you would see transfer. And so really the point that I'm making here is that if you have this noise, it inhibits destructive interference, and it opens additional paths for the system to propagate. And if you have a complicated network, then it can propagate through more paths than it could before.
In your example of Alice and Bob, you said that you'd be able to detect an eavesdropper by the difference in what the communication is you sent and what actually gets there. But how does Bob know what he's supposed to be getting to detect whether there's an eavesdropper or not?
Yes, so that's why really so what happens is you send a lot of messages, and then Alice and Bob, after they have been sent, they choose, so Alice chooses a random selection of those. Let's say she says the 2nd, the 5th, the 13th, and so on. So she takes those signals, and she tells Bob what they were. She tells Bob what she has sent. And because she chooses them after the transmission randomly, the eavesdropper cannot sort of say, oh, I avoid looking at those. And therefore, if there's an eavesdropper, he will have attacked some of those. And then from the difference between Alice and Bob, they can infer that there's an eavesdropper in between. So they have to actually publicly communicate. But the great thing is that this can be done publicly. There's no problem with it. You sacrifice a little bit of your transmissions to find out whether the rest of it is safe or not, or at least to find out what you have to do about the problem.
I see there are a lot more questions. Maybe we should allow one or two more.
My question was similar, but it seems like in Alice and Bob's situation, you need some kind of feedback mechanism. Mm-hmm. And every time you interrupt one of these quantum signals, you put a perturbation on it. So how do you make sure that communication back and forth between Alice and Bob, the feedback information isn't changed in some ways?
The public communication between Alice and Bob is exactly of the nature that the two of us are doing. It's sending classical signals so everybody can listen to them. Of course, there is a problem that someone could sit in, I mean, there could be someone who puts here an invisible membrane or so, and it records the sound that I'm emitting. Nothing of that comes through to you, and he transmits something else to you. That's the man in the middle attack, actually, has a name. That's something that this doesn't protect against. I mean, even quantum cryptography is not absolutely secure. It is secure under a certain set of assumptions. The interesting thing is that you can specify these assumptions very well, and if they hold, then law of nature guarantees the security of the scheme, namely the validity of quantum mechanics. While in classical schemes, you make various assumptions, but then at some point, there's always this thing of, well, and now we have to assume that this mathematical procedure is very difficult, and therefore nobody can do it. But this has not been mathematically proven. And so it could just be that someone is more clever than we are and is perfectly permitted and has a wonderful algorithm that can actually break this code. And that has happened in the past and can happen again. There's absolutely no guarantee. And so that's a fundamental difference. In one case, law of nature. The other one is just an unproven difficulty of a certain problem. I can move me.
So just one more Alice and Bob question. Yeah. Do you have to significantly increase the amount of data transferred to get a reasonable amount of security? Or
It depends on, okay, so there's something that I didn't mention, of course. I mean, if you have a quantum if you have a channel, it can also be have innocent noise, so to speak. And so the amount of data that you have to sacrifice depends on the overall noise level in your channel. Because you have to assume that whatever noise there is, it could have come from an eavesdropper. And the more there is, the more you have to sacrifice. But if the noise level is reasonable, which is what you want to assume anyway, what you want to achieve technologically, then you don't have to sacrifice too much. But this is, again, this is a practical question more than, there are formulas that tell you what you have to sacrifice, and it just means that you have to transmit a bit more. But it's not necessarily that you have to sacrifice 99.999% or so.
Yeah. I have a question on the same matter, actually, that you assume that the perturbance is coming only from the eavesdropper. It could be coming, as you said, as innocent from at the receiver or at the sender, actually, randomly. If you consider the sender and receiver as quantum entities, that source of the perturbance could be there as well.
Yes, yes. I mean, if you build a device, the ones that you can buy or so, they have different types of noise. I mean, even if there's no eavesdropper, there is a noise level there. So this is totally unavoidable. But the nice thing is that if you apply these procedures, no matter where the noise is coming from, you can essentially remove it and make sure that the remaining sort of entries in your notebooks, you know that only you have knowledge about them, and your sender and receiver, and nobody else. And also, I have to say that I am sender, you are receiver. We are both pretty classical objects, so we don't suffer too much quantum fluctuations in let's say, our handwriting and stuff like that. But of course, these are fundamental questions, and people are now pushing this further and further there. I mean, cryptographers are, sort of notoriously, suspicious about everything, and they have to be, because they have to really, if you want to prove the security of some system, you have to really look at what could be the possible points that we either have to make assumptions or where we have to make proofs that we can get rid of these entry points for an eavesdropper. And there are many, many things that you have to take into account, and very subtle. And I think by doing this, one learns an awful lot about quantum mechanics, actually.
Last question.
Yeah.
I didn't understand a lot of what you said. But one of the things that confused me is the language. You use the words particle or wave in most of your description. Mm-hmm. Are those the only two alternatives? I mean, does anybody do any work on detecting something besides what you call a wave or a particle? Is there anything else besides waves and particles?
Well, I mean, let's say we use quantum mechanics, and the way that we speak about quantum mechanics tends to be in either waves or particles, and that is the best way we can speak about this.
Nobody detected anything besides this ever?
Well, I mean, if you
described anything different?
Quantum mechanics still holds, it seems. So it has not. I mean, quantum mechanics can explain. Can explain all our experiments so far.
I suggest that since Martin is around for questions also during lunchtime and during the break, we go for the break now, and let's thank the speaker again.